You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm delighted to welcome you to the RSA, particularly anyone who's not been here before. I'm Alison Critchley. I'm Chief Executive of RSA Academy, so I work with our family of schools. And I'm delighted to welcome you to our very special lunchtime talk. It is my very great pleasure to introduce this afternoon's guest speaker, Daniela Sieve. Daniela is a writer with her roots in evolutionary anthropology and an active interest in the dynamics of the psyche. She has a doctorate in biological anthropology from Oxford University and a first degree in human sciences, which I also share, so I'm very excited that Daniela's here. And her research has taken her as far as the wilderness region of Tanzania to live with traditional cattle herding people for many years. Pleased to have you back in civilization today. For the past 9 years, though, Daniela has been writing and researching her latest book, Understanding and Healing Emotional Trauma. And she joins us today to talk about the findings in that book, which is based on conversations with a range of clinicians and researchers in those fields, and is written in a way that's accessible not just to researchers, but to a much wider audience. So, Daniela, we're delighted to have you here. Without further ado, can I invite you to come and take the stage?
As a culture, we're becoming increasingly aware of how widespread trauma is and of the huge emotional and physical costs of those who carry it. We're becoming aware of the damage that it creates in our communities and in our wider societies through the way that it affects how we parent children, how we interact with each other, how it creates the background environment against which far too many people live their lives. And I believe that addressing trauma individually and on a societal level is vital if we're going to prevent it from becoming ever more prevalent. However, there's a great deal of misunderstanding about what trauma is. And unless we develop greater clarity, we won't be able to engage with it as effectively as we might. 15 years ago, I started exploring the phenomenon of trauma, mainly for personal reasons. But alongside my own inner work, I studied and interviewed some of the leading researchers and clinicians of today. They came from three different fields: psychotherapy, neurobiology, and evolutionary anthropology. And bringing their understanding together with my own personal experience helped me to see trauma in an expanded context. Today, I'm going to convey some of the key insights that emerged from this process. When people think about trauma, they think about being the victim of harm, and they perceive that the trauma resides in those harmful experiences themselves. But that's a misunderstanding, and one that we need to correct if we're going to be able to create the personal and the social environments that can facilitate healing. Trauma means a wound, a shock, or an injury. Thus, it does not reside in the harmful experiences per se, but in their impact on us. When we suffer from pain that's unbearable, pain and fear, and what's unbearable for one person will be different to what's unbearable for another, and it'll depend on how old we are and particularly on how much social support we've got, as well as various other factors. But when somebody suffers pain and fear, which for them is unbearable, they develop an unconscious conviction that their life is at risk. And as a result of that, our minds and our bodies activate various systems whose sole purpose is aimed at survival. And once these systems have been activated, we live our lives from inside a biological and psychological world that is fundamentally different to the world that we would have lived in previously. I call this a trauma world. And it is entry into this trauma world which defines trauma, not the original events. So what constitutes a trauma world? Well, that will vary from person to person. Every trauma world will be unique. But there are three systems that are active in all trauma worlds. There's an embodied fear of re-traumatization. There's a propensity to dissociate, to cut off from parts of ourselves. And our identity will become rooted in shame. I'll talk about each in turn, but for now I need to emphasise that there's no conscious decision to enter a trauma world. It's what human brains and bodies have evolved to do in the face of overwhelming pain and fear. What's more, a trauma world is not created in the thinking parts of our brain, the parts that are accessible to everyday awareness and to language, but rather in the hidden biological systems, in our hormones, in our nervous system, and in the structure of our brain, and those parts of those systems which underlie our feelings and the ways that we perceive the world and interact with the world and with people around us. And that means that we have little awareness that we're locked into this kind of world, and to a world that's organised around fear, dissociation and shame. But that is the reality. And it's a reality which distorts how we see ourselves and others. And as a result of that distortion, and as a result of the way that we behave because of that, we're going to create repetitive and self-perpetuating cycles of trauma, both for ourselves and because of how we're interacting. We're going to create the kind of environments which might well constellate trauma in others. So what kinds of experiences create trauma? Well, the most obvious ones are the ones that are currently in the news, like physical and sexual abuse, extreme neglect, growing up among violence, experiencing war, or witnessing atrocities. More hidden, but equally damaging, is growing up feeling inadequate, unvalued, or unloved. Trauma is also triggered in infants and young children when they have parents and caregivers who are unable to attune to them in a sensitive way, perhaps because those caregivers are traumatized themselves, maybe because they're stressed, maybe because they're depressed or ill. Sometimes the original traumatizing experiences happen to our parents and grandparents rather than to us. And then it is their fears and their distorted perceptions which are inherited from them, which lie at the heart of our trauma world. So turning now to the three systems that form the core of a trauma world, I'll begin by talking about fear. The first response to emotional wounding is that our minds and our bodies become extremely sensitive to potential danger. It's not conscious. It happens through changes that take place in our hormones, in our nervous system, in the structure of our brains. But what it means is that we look at other people and the world around us through a haze of anxiety and distrust. And we often see danger where none exists. And then we react to that imagined danger in the very way that brings about the situations that we most fear. We're imagining something that's happening and we react, and then we create huge problems. Our fear system becomes particularly sensitive around our original traumatizing experiences. At the core of a trauma world is the defiant cry of "Never again will I be re-traumatized." But never again can cause as much pain as the original wounding. In an attempt to avoid anything that seems to resemble the traumatizing experiences, we try to control the situation, other people, and ourselves. Often that attempt at self-control is unconscious, but at some subtle or less subtle level, we effectively become control freaks. One way that unconscious need for control can be played out is through distorted beliefs, which we are certain represent our truth. Say we lost our caregiver when we were a young child. Perhaps they died or walked out. Perhaps they were depressed or ill. Perhaps they withdrew. To ensure that never again did we experience similar loss, we might develop an unconscious belief that we're not really lovable. Because with a belief like that, we wouldn't let anyone get close enough to us. And so we wouldn't have to risk the pain of possibly losing them had we let them in and then they disappeared again. There are a myriad of different distorted beliefs that can become part of a trauma world. They're all individual, but all lead to a profound inner loneliness. because all leave us abandoning a genuine part of ourselves. In this particular example, the need for connection and for love. Sometimes it's impossible to avoid situations that appear similar to the ones that traumatized us. Then our old trauma comes back to life, not as a memory of the past, but as a living knee-jerk reaction. A bit like riding a bicycle. When you get on a bicycle now, you don't remember your stages of learning to ride it. There's an embodied reaction to so that you can balance. However, with trauma, when we're unaware that it's come back to life, when it gets triggered in that way. And so we believe that what we're feeling right now is the reality of right now. And then we behave in ways that can hurt both ourselves and others. The second system that forms a trauma world is dissociation. Dissociation is part of the mammalian defense system. In extreme situations when we need to escape, we need to not feel the pain. We need to just run, whether our leg is broken or whatever. We need to get out of there. But in a trauma world, it becomes part of everyday life. And then it's harmful because it cuts us off from our own reality as well as from the reality of the situation. There's several types of dissociation which are common to trauma. Today I've got time just to mention two of them. When those upon whom we depend can't accept some aspect of who we are, maybe our anger or our tears, maybe our joy or our sexuality, maybe our ambition or our creativity, maybe our body and our physicality, whatever it is, we cut off that part of ourselves. It's not a conscious decision. It just happens. But once it's happened, we build our lives around this half person who we have become. And that leaves us feeling insecure. We're worried that we'll be discovered as a fraud. We're not standing on our own ground because we've cut off part of ourselves. We don't feel quite real. There's a sense of emptiness. Sometimes it's not a specific part of our personality that we cut off, but emotions more generally. When pain and fear are overwhelming, we numb out and blot those feelings from consciousness. We have to get through everyday life, to get through school if we're kids, to get through whatever's required of us as adults. But we can't block out pain and fear without cutting off from all emotions or for dulling them down. And when we do that, we can't engage with other people and with the world around us in a vibrant way. And then we feel life feels a bit flat and it feels a bit depressed. We're very prone to suffering from depression at that point. And we also feel less than fully human because we see our friends and other people around us being much more engaged with life. And we feel that that's not really for us. So there must be something wrong with us. Cut off from our emotions, we're also denied the information that would help us to find our way through the world. Emotions are a product of evolution, and they evolve to tell us whether what's happening around us is good or whether it's bad. Should we approach it? Should we withdraw? When we're dissociated from our feelings and they're dulled, we don't have access to the nuances and the texture of that kind of information can give us. And without that information, it's harder to find our way in the world. And so the sense of danger that's already part of a trauma world is made worse. Shame is the third system that's intrinsic to trauma worlds. It is a visceral and all-pervasive feeling of being fundamentally flawed and inadequate as a human being. Shame is often confused with guilt. But with guilt, we feel bad about the things we've done. With shame, we feel bad about who we are. Guilt is about actions. Shame is about being. Shame is mediated by the emotional brain. So although it's often accompanied by self-critical thoughts like I'm stupid, useless, bad, pathetic, ultimately, it's lived as a total experiences that lodges beneath thoughts and words and sucks us into the psychological equivalent of a black hole. Shame is also a product of evolution, and it can be felt as a passing emotion in everybody. But with emotional trauma, it becomes an enduring part of our ongoing identity. Instead of just feeling it for a moment, it becomes who we are. And then we can't step outside it and see it for what it is. Instead, we have no choice but to see ourselves through shame-tinted glasses. We become the object of our own contempt. At some deep level, we feel ourselves to be a victim of our own supposed inadequacy. And then we try and bully and indeed shame ourselves into success. We try to force ourselves to become more than we are, often striving for perfection, in the vain hope that if only we can become perfect, then that gnawing pain of feeling sort of inadequate, really at the core of our being, will finally go away. But when we try and shame ourselves into change, all we do is create more shame. It's not only our relationship with ourselves which is poisoned by shame. Our relationship with other people is equally distorted. We're terrified that if they get to know us, we'll be abandoned or attacked. And in a conscious attempt to prevent that imagined danger from happening, we put up barriers, we push people away, or we try to gain power over them, perhaps using force, or we might try to manipulate them through being a martyr or through being hyper nice. We're not conscious that we're doing any of this. This isn't happening as a kind of decision to do it. It's kind of learnt very slowly over years and years and years. But we aren't having real relationships. And so at some level, we feel increasingly isolated. Also, because we sense that our relationships aren't quite real, that we're not quite relating to other people and that they're not quite relating to us in a really meaningful way, the conviction that there's something wrong with us as a human being gets worse. And so we go deeper into shame. Shame creates more shame. So how can trauma be healed in ourselves and in others? The first challenge is that the systems that constitute trauma are so deeply ingrained in our bodies and our brains that we as individuals and also as a society struggle to see trauma for what it is. Instead, our focus is drawn to the visible symptoms and to the chronic deadening pain which they create. I've already talked about how trauma can create anxiety, dissociation, and a deep sense of inadequacy, and how these in turn can lead to a sense of insecurity, isolation, meaninglessness, and depression. Other symptoms include addictions, eating disorders, self-harm, rage, unexplained physical ailments, as well as feeling stuck in our lives, struggling with relationships, sabotaging the things that we care about. Focusing on these symptoms, we as individuals and as a society put our energy and our resources into trying to alleviate them. That's of limited use. Until we recognize and engage with the underlying trauma, we're sticking plasters over broken bones, and so we're not going to get any really solid and lasting and change that we can really rely on and trust. Even when people can see beneath the symptoms to the underlying trauma, the first port of call is usually to blame whoever or whatever caused those original wounds and to look for retribution. That's okay as a first step. We do need to recognize what happened to us. We do need to validate it. And we need to know that it's happened not because there's something wrong with who we are. But it is only a first step. And focusing on those traumatizing experiences or on punishing the perpetrators won't bring lasting healing because it can't change the internal systems created in the wake of those traumatizing experiences. Jailing the drunk driver isn't going to mend our broken leg. The next step, and to truly heal trauma, requires the courage to recognize that ultimately our lives are compromised not by the original traumatizing experiences per se, but by this inner trauma world that was created in their wake. And we need to recognize that reality without blame and judgment. We need to understand that that's what human beings do in order to survive. And at the same time, we have to take responsibility for transforming those survival systems and for finding our own way out of that trauma world. So how do we do that? Well, a cognitive awareness of the traumatizing experiences and of the systems that were created in their wake is a start. But it is not enough. Exploring the past from a safe distance won't bring lasting change. Instead, we have to go into our emotional bodies and our minds and slowly get to know what we carry from inside of our feelings. Not from inside of our thoughts, but from inside of our feelings. We need to engage with our trauma and find different ways of relating to it. Change happens in the present moment through lived experience. And the first thing that needs to happen as part of that lived experience is that we need to become more tolerant of the original traumatizing pain. That's hard. Pain tells us that something's wrong. We've evolved to want to get out of pain and to avoid it. But at the root of our trauma world is the acute pain, which was previously too much for us to bear. And so long as we remain frightened of that pain, we have no choice but to keep our survival systems rigidly in place and for never again to be the organizing principle of our lives. Opening to our original pain is not enough in and of itself to bring healing. We also have to work directly with the survival systems created in both mind and body in response to that traumatizing pain. For example, we have to reconnect to whatever has been dissociated. That's frightening. We dissociated these parts of ourselves to protect ourselves from being re-traumatized. When we approach these parts, our fear system is automatically reactivated. It's a bit like, you know, you're living in the African plains and you get mauled by a lion, and suddenly you're saying, actually, we're going to now go up and try and pet a lion. Everything in you is saying, you've got to be joking. You're completely crazy. There is no way you're going anywhere near that. You go near that, you're going to get attacked. And so driven by that imperative of never again, our survival systems will do everything they can to prevent us from reconnecting to what was branded as dangerous all those years ago and what was genuinely dangerous for us to live all those years ago. And if that means sabotaging the healing process, then so be it. In truth, one of the hardest parts of healing trauma is challenging the power of that internal survival system. But if we can take on that system successfully enough to reconnect to the parts that we've dissociated, we can begin to build a more vibrant and meaningful life. One that's securely rooted in the entirety of who we are, rather than in this half person we became to survive. Equally critical to healing trauma is that we engage with our shame. So long as our identity is underlain by shame, there is no healing. But the core of shame lies in our emotional brains and in our bodies. So once again, although a cognitive awareness of our shame is important and is a first step, we need to go beyond or beneath that and work from inside our feelings of shame. And that leaves us feeling terrifyingly exposed and vulnerable. And that takes me to the last point I want to make about healing. We cannot heal emotional trauma by ourselves. We need help. That help can come from a counsellor, a therapist, a teacher, a social worker, or a healing group. But it's what we experience within the context of healing relationships that transforms the fear, the dissociation, and the shame that lie at the heart of a trauma world. And that has consequences for people who accompany others through healing. Because of our neurobiology, because of who we are as human beings, those who help others to heal must have worked deeply with their own trauma. Otherwise, they can't create the kinds of relationships which offer new experiences. It's like learning to speak and inhabit a new language like Chinese. We're learning to speak and inhabit a new emotional language if we're going to heal trauma. And to learn that language, our teacher must speak that language rather than simply understand its grammar in a theoretical way and being able to recognise the characters when they're written down on a page. So to conclude, what does it mean to be healed? When we embark on trying to heal trauma, we typically imagine that we will reach a place where our lives are free from the pain and the fear arising from our wounds, where trauma no longer has any effect on our lives. That is not what happens. We cannot change the past. Our wounds remain part of us. But what can be changed is their impact. And to achieve that, we have to find new and healthier ways of being with the pain and the fear that's embedded in those wounds. And just as importantly, we have to transform the trauma world which was developed around them. It's a challenging process. It takes time. Successive governments have adopted short-term cognitive therapy, which focuses primarily on the thinking brain, as their treatment of choice. However, to heal trauma, we need to work directly with the emotional brain and with the physical body. And that requires longer-term relational therapy. And if we as a society want to address trauma in a meaningful way, then we need to provide that longer-term relational therapy in our health system, in our schools, and in our social services. And I believe it's vitally important that we do that, both to help those who are traumatized, and also because when we carry unaddressed trauma, we have no choice but to relate to our children, our family, our neighbours and our colleagues through a distorting veil of fear, dissociation and shame, however subtle it is, but we will be relating to them through those distortions. And that then fosters the kind of social and emotional environments which create yet more trauma and suffering in others. It becomes a vicious spiral. In contrast, as we transform our survival systems and make our way out of our trauma worlds, we break that spiral and start relating to other people and to the world around us in much healthier ways. Ways that are healthy not only for ourselves, but also for the communities in which we live.
Daniela, thank you for that. It was absolutely fascinating and so clear. Can I start with where you ended, talking about the vicious spiral and breaking the cycle with children? I work with schools. There'll be large numbers of children in the academies that I work with who are experiencing trauma on a personal level. My children are adopted, so I know they've got that experience. For those of us who are working with children, with schools, parenting children, what are the sorts of things we can do to start that healing process with young children and young people?
Well, one of the main factors in whether a painful experience becomes traumatizing or not is, do we have anybody we can talk to about who can see us in that experience, who can validate it? A lot of the time, you know, we're told, you're not valid, you know, just shut up or don't talk. So, I mean, crucially important, if kids have somewhere where they can actually talk about it, somebody that they can talk to, some kind of safe space, that makes a phenomenal difference. They, you know, can learn that it's not them, it's not necessarily that there's something wrong with them. The problem is that you can't take away these kids' defense systems if they're still living in an environment that's traumatizing. So you've really got to work with parents. You know, if there's problems at home, you've got to be able to be working with the parents and trying to change that environment. But even if you're not doing that, just having somebody at school or in a club, a teacher who understands you, can make a phenomenal difference. And it's just about listening. It's not about saying, oh, well, it's okay, because it's not okay.
Yes. And then thinking about adults and working with adults, how does this, that understanding that it's not about the event, it's about the impact that has had on their bodies and in a very deep way, how does that sort of logical knowledge and understanding help with the healing process?
That's a great question, because ultimately the logical knowledge doesn't bring healing. The healing comes from coming into the feelings and feeling the edge of them and then feeling a little bit more, I mean, very, very gently, but going to that edge. But what the knowledge can do is it can hold you as you do that. You know, doing that is a terribly frightening process. And if you understand, you've got a framework within which to understand what that process is, it's, you know, it becomes less frightening. I mean, we experience, for the same kind of physical injury, if you don't know what it is and you're frightened, it's much harder to tolerate the pain than if you know what it is. Yeah. So knowing what it is can help to hold us as we do that work. It can also help to tell us what we need to do, you know, that this is normal and that this is...
Yes, it's a very interesting analogy with the physical, yes, not understanding why. And then in your book, you talk about the three different perspectives and what they bring. And I know you are pressed for time, but can you just say a little bit about each of the perspectives and what that adds to the understanding of the impact of trauma and the healing process?
Well, the psychotherapeutic perspective, the psychodynamic, really talks about what it's like inside our subjective experience. So it describes these dynamics in a way that resonate with how we live them, that how they feel to us. And that's really important because we can see ourselves in them. You know, we come across them and we go, oh, I recognise that. And there's also that helps because with trauma we feel so isolated. Though moments of recognition, we suddenly realise we're not alone. So that perspective reading about, you know, is really helpful. The neurobiology tells us what's happening physically in our brains and our bodies. So when I said, you know, when we can't avoid something that's similar to the traumatizing experience and our old memories get triggered, what's actually happening with that kind of memory? It's not something that we understand. You know, I remember when I first learned about it, because we have all this cognitive, oh, yes, well, I know it's not rational to be behaving this way. I know I'm now a grown-up and that, you know, I'm not in that situation anymore. There must be something really wrong with me for still reacting like that, right? So when you learn about the other memory systems, there's ones that are embodied, and you realise that that's what's being activated. So it can give us that kind of knowledge. And the evolutionary perspective really tells us about why humans are traumatised by certain things. Why is it so traumatising for infants to have a parent that's not attuned to them? I mean, you know, all our kids are surviving, and right? So if your mum's not really quite attuned to you, why does that actually bring trauma? What is it about being a human primate and our history and millions of years of history that means that... And again, what that does is when we see parts of ourselves in that context, instead of thinking, oh, well, I'm inadequate for behaving that way, we actually understand that that links us to being human, that that's part of our humanity.
And so on that, the bit about being attuned, what is it that makes that so...
What makes that is that for most of human history, and in many traditional societies today, I worked in Africa for many years, you know, 40 to 50% of kids are dying before they're 15. That's what it's been for millions of years, right? Hundreds of millions of years. And in those circumstances, when you're living in an environment where food can be very sporadic, where there's disease and ill health and predators... Yeah. Whether your mother is attuned to you and responsive to you or not is literally life and death.
Right, yes.
So if you take trauma as feeling that your survival is at risk, having a mother who isn't there for you was, you know, meant that you were likely to be one of those 50% that died rather than one of the ones. Knowing that your mother preferred your sibling to you, right? In times of drought, when the food dried up...
Yep.
You know, we sit there and go, oh, well, you know, it's ridiculous that I'm so damaged or whatever by the fact that I knew that I wasn't my mum's favourite child. No, you know, for most of our evolutionary history, that would have been life and death during famine. So it gives us a context for understanding this.
Gosh, and puts huge pressure on us parents as well. Equal treatment of children. Okay, I'd like to open up the questions to the floor, please. Let me take a couple at a time. Let me start on this side. The gentleman here and then the gentleman at the front.
Hi, Peter Sear, I'm a fellow here. You mentioned briefly at the beginning about trauma passed down from parents and grandparents. I wonder if you were talking about something consciously or subconsciously, or perhaps epigenetics?
Okay.
And if so, if you talk about that in your book, and what the latest ideas on that are.
Okay.
Is it ever possible to treat or seek to heal emotional trauma unless you've actually been through it yourself?
Right, okay.
Take those two.
In terms of passing down from generation to generation, some of it is conscious and some of it, I think, is not conscious. I think the majority of it is not conscious. So, to give you an example, my mother was a Holocaust refugee. She got out of Poland on day three of Hitler's invasion, but she was young and she had a sense that the world was a dangerous place, that it could turn against you. Don't think that was conscious, but I grew up in a world. You know, it's like growing up in China. You grow up with an environment that's speaking Chinese. My environment at home was of this world as a dangerous place. At times, it was conscious. She tried to instill it, but most of it's unconscious. The epigenetics, and so there's some of that is talked to. Some of the interviews talk about that, different chapters, both from the biological perspective. The epigenetics is now showing us that genes can be switched on or off depending on what's happening in our environment. And if there's a lot of fear in the environment, the genes that make us more hypersensitive to danger get switched on. And that switching on of those genes seems to be able to be passed down. So we don't just inherit the DNA from our parents, we also inherit some of those little switches that turn the volume up and down. It's mentioned briefly in the book. That isn't a lot of the epigenetics in the book. But yes, they're going hand in hand, of course, those systems.
And then the second question was about whether you can really treat trauma if you haven't been through that yourself, Neil.
Part of what's happening when you're treating trauma is going on unconsciously and implicitly and at an embodied level. So somebody comes to you with pain and fear that they've shut off and that they can't cope with, and actually they need to see unconsciously, and Alan Shaw talks about it in the book in a kind of right brain non-verbal way, is that kind of level of pain and fear can be held and it can be tolerated. And I think if you've got somebody who hasn't been through that and who hasn't, you're not going to be able to learn that from them because they don't have that. So I think it'd be very difficult. I do think it's like trying to learn to speak Chinese from someone who knows the grammar and the writing. I do think you need someone who is versed with it. And I think that is because of what's, you know, partly what's happening neurobiologically. We are mirroring. We've got mirror systems going on. And I think some of the most important thing that's happening in healing is that mirror system's being activated way below what's being said in words.
My name is Tiki Martel, and thank you for such a clear talk. I'm not making a statement, but a question. This trauma that we hold on to sometimes is extremely necessary. And you mentioned shame and guilt that leads to accusation and demand. How about, I wonder why you didn't mention resentment and victimhood, which we hold on to consciously and unconsciously, like dear life. And the more vulnerable we are, we can't make sense of letting go of it. We hold on to it.
Thank you.
Thank you for that very clear talk. My name is Chris Olsen. I'm a psychotherapist with the Independent Group of Analytical Psychology here in London. And we practice a psychology where we would use to try to come into touch with these dissociated parts that you've talked about. We would use the dream often to help us find that dissociation, because if it's unconscious, how do we find it? And then the feelings that come up in the reimagining the dream during the session. I wonder if that echoes well with your research?
We do hang on. I didn't talk about resentment and victimhood. I do talk about victimhood in the book, actually. I think, firstly, we live in a society that kind of reifies the victim. So if we can hold on to it, there's a feeling of having at least some power. And with trauma, one of the things is that we feel so disempowered to stop whatever's happening to us. And we're told again and again in our society here that, you know, to be a victim is to have power. So I think it becomes a very difficult thing to let go of. And also when we have no other power, we feel it gives us something. You know, people have somehow got to be nice to us. It kind of becomes a way to control. It is ultimately toxic because it stops us moving, stops us addressing what we carry inside of us. I think it's also one of the methods that kind of survival system uses to stop us from going near anything. You know, if we could think of ourselves as a victim, then actually it hides the fact that it's the systems that got put in place inside of us that we need to deal with. We're a victim to outside, to what happened. And actually, you know, so then we don't really need to deal with what happened. The idea of retribution, I think humans evolved to want that at some degree. And we do get, when we punish somebody who perpetrates, we do get a dopamine buzz, right? And that's probably something to do with being group living and trying to have to need to get everyone. But it's a very transient buzz, right? And again, it's not going to heal the system. It's not going to. If you took it as a drunk driver, you know, yes, it'd be great to see him jailed because your leg's broken, but you need the surgeon to put the leg back, the bone, and then you need to do the physiotherapy if you're going to really want to walk again. And actually sticking in victim and resentment stops you from having to take responsibility for doing that, the psychological equivalent of the physiotherapy. But it's a great point, and it's something I do try to talk about a bit more in the book, and something I'd love to expand on one day. Second question about dreams and getting to those parts. Absolutely. I mean, these parts, as I keep saying, have been tried to get across, are held in our feelings and in our bodies. And that's not accessible. That's kind of mediated through the right brain and through our bodies. It's not accessible to verbal language. And one of the things that dreams do is they come from the right brain and they also come out of our bodies. So if we work with dreams, they do give us access to some of those parts. Similarly, we can work with movement. We can work with drawing, with free art. We can work with writing if we kind of switch our thinking brain off and just write. Somehow to get past that filter, that control filter, that's A, trying to hide that, keep us in control and to keep those things out of consciousness and to keep them away. But yes, I mean, very powerful methods of getting to some of what we've dissociated. Absolutely. The problem is that, you know, it's all too easy to work with dreams nicely analytically and to talk about them, rather than to really embody them and live them. You know, we can sort of recognise these parts of ourselves and then we walk out in the street and we haven't done anything with it. So I think that can be one danger with dream work. It can be very numinous, but actually it can be too easy. It can be sometimes be easy not to live it and not to feel it in our bodies, to not go into the emotions associated.
Lucy Wills, RSA Fellow and Design Researcher. I think... This is quite revolutionary because it does turn on its head a lot of people's understanding of psychology and how to deal with traumatic events. I think my specific question is about the judicial system and about how, you know, how can this... if everybody in the police or the social services had an understanding of this, how would it... how do you think it should change the way that we deal with people who have caused trauma to us? And also, do you think there's something that we can do as individuals to, not to have a big Oprah moment and reconcile with the people who've caused us trauma, but to let people know that they've done something?
Think about that one.
Thank you. The gentleman in the middle.
Very quickly, what would you need to observe to know that your intervention has been successful? What factors do you look... What tells you it's working?
part of that is happening implicitly. So you have to be in contact with what you're feeling, because it's happening through your right brain, through the non-verbals. And actually, if you're connected enough to your body, you can feel those changes in other people. I think what tells you it's working is, you know, when people are with you, are they disappearing? Are there moments when there's kind of a going blank, or is there less of those moments? How far can they engage with you? Where's the shame? You know, shame has a very, unlike guilt, but shame has very obvious body postures. We go down into ourselves, we look down a bit. Are people sitting up and meeting you more? Are they meeting your eyes more? Are they willing to be there? But I think ultimately it's about that intuitive gut feeling of what you're picking up through those non-verbals. You know, that's why it's not a cognitive. It comes from the experience, and it comes from the experience that if you've lived it and you've been through the trauma and you know what it is to feel more comfortable with your trauma, you recognise that in other people as they're able to do that. For people, you know, are they feeling, I mean, ultimately, yes, of course, you know, are you feeling depressed? Has somebody been thinking about doing, you know, committing suicide? Are someone still self-harming? Are they, you know, there's, obviously, are those, if you really get at the trauma, those symptoms will go, right? You're not going to be feeling depressed, and you're not going to be feeling, but in the moment, but that's over time, right? That is something you see happening very, very, very gradually. You know, somebody, well, with some of those symptoms. But obviously you'd expect, you know, if what you're doing is working, that those symptoms would start to go. Yes. But that's not in the it's not necessarily in the moment that you know, that's a longer term. It's incremental, exactly. And you've got to have a sensitivity to pick up to that. That's exactly right.
And then there was the question about how would the police, the judiciary and social services react differently, and should we have our own Oprah moment to sort of move us on?
To be fair, I don't know enough about how the police and the judicial system do work with this. I don't know how much support is given to people who are going through it, and how much, in terms of, at some level and at the right time, redirecting them back to how they might be able to, you know, what support systems might then be in place for them to work with those consequences, with this trauma world that they've got. I don't know if once... That's not really my area. In terms of, you know, the perpetrators... I mean, it's a cliche to say, but most people who are perpetrators are people who are carrying trauma. Right, there's a few people who might just have brains that are kind of don't feel emotions and don't feel empathy, who are at an extreme end, but very few. Most people who are actually hurting others, you know, are people who are traumatized themselves and who don't know, who are either in shame and want power over somebody, want to feel bigger than somebody, whatever it is. That doesn't excuse it. It doesn't mean that, you know, you can say that it's okay that they've behaved this way, because it's not okay. But it does maybe change how you would, locking someone up in jail with no treatment, if that's how they've behaved, is probably very unlikely to make a difference, because they're still carrying their trauma and now they're probably carrying more shame and they're probably dissociated more parts themselves, and when they come out, they're going to be as stuck in that trauma and as likely to behave out of that trauma as before they went in. So I think it kind of, you know, has an effect at that level.
Okay, we're getting to 2 o'clock. Can we take just the last couple of questions? There's one in the middle.
Hello, Claire Mead. I'm really interested in the relationship between trauma and illness, unexplained physical illnesses, and the idea that trauma can be inherited, as indeed alcoholism can be inherited in families, and people say somebody will drink because they've had a trauma in their past. Is there a link, do you think, between alcoholism and trauma, and it can carry on through the generations, through the family? And with that, any form of addiction, it doesn't have to be alcoholism.
Mary Wood, a fellow of the RSA and a psychotherapist specializing in eating disorders. So I see a lot of how people act out and, of course, how people are disassociating with their bodies. So my question is, when someone has, and also adding to that what you said about how with eating disorders, it is almost always the symptom of not eating, restrictive eating, that's treated rather than any of the root causes. But also the question is, when people are being very, very restrictive about their eating, or indeed perhaps their cognitions are affected very much by alcohol or drugs, I think that there is a point where the physical, where you talked about dopamine or cortisol flooding the brain, changes our way of being able to deal at all with emotions. So I was just wondering about the, I suppose the neuroscience and the disassociation are connected.
Yes, I mean, they are connected, and they form a spiral, because obviously once you get your becoming more dissociated, you are changing, there's changes going on in the brain, and those changes that are going on in the brain will then change how you behave and how you relate. So you do form these spirals. I mean, and of course they have to, because in terms of our experiences and our feelings, how else is it going to be expressed apart from in changes in our brains and in our bodies? And as you say, yes, there's, you know, so many of these are treated by trying to get people to eat again or whatever it is, rather than looking at the underlying cause. Marion Woodman, in the book, who I interview, is a Jungian analyst, but who struggled with eating disorders for much of her life, and she talks about what underlay that and where her desire to get away from her body and from the pain that was in it and to get into spirit came from, really. And it's a similar question to the question on alcoholism. You know, when we've got trauma and we are dissociated and we are carrying shame and we're carrying fear, actually, in many of those addictive moments, you know, when we're drunk or when we're high, because if you stop eating for long enough, you kind of get high, right? In those moments are moments actually where people often can get a sense of what it feels like to be whole. Bruce Lloyd talks about this in his interview. You know, in those moments, actually, we can bring back some of the parts of us that we're not living, and we get past the shame and we get past the dissociation. A lot of those addictions are kind of misguided attempts to heal. They're misguided. They're not even escape from pains, but they're misguided attempts to get past the fear, the dissociation, and the shame. And they're misguided because we're looking for something outside of us to fix it for us, rather than trying to change our relationship with inside of us. In terms of the physicality, that's now, I mean, there's a ton of evidence on that. And what happens is if there's childhood trauma and you're stressed and you've got stress hormones running around you, right, so cortisol and whatever, and you've got high levels of stress hormones, it has an effect on your immune system. So there's a lot more autoimmune disease. There's more cancer. Having stress hormones running around your body is, you know, leads to higher heart attacks, greater cancer. It goes on and on and on, basically everything. So the physical costs are immense, shorter lives, and that's probably working through that hormonal system. In terms of being passed on, that can get passed on in the womb. If you've got a mum who's carrying trauma and who's stressed, or, you know, it might be that our
her marriage suddenly feels insecure, her husband's just lost her job, or she's not sure she'll get back into the workforce, she's living through a recession, or whatever it is. If you've got a lot of stress hormones circulating when you're pregnant, that already sets the infant's fear system onto being much more sensitive. So an infant's already born with that. And through the epigenetics, in an inherited way, those switches that turn up that thermostat can get passed on through both men and through women. I think now through sperm they're showing as well, and through eggs. So you're inheriting that hypersensitive fear system. And once you've got a hypersensitive fear system, you live it out. So 2 nights ago, my alarm goes off. I've just had a new door fixed. The contact wasn't working. 6:30 in the evening, my alarm goes off, right? I know what it is. I can see the door. Cognitively, I know exactly what it is. Every time I hear a rustle outside, I'm like this, right? Every time. I'm sitting there with a flashlight. I live in the country. I'm sitting there with my African, from when I lived out in Tanzania, my mega flashlight. I've got it by my bedside table. Cognitively, I know exactly what's going on. But you know what? I am completely overreacting to every moment of it. So, you know, if we grow up in that environment, then we create danger because we're going to... You know, what are you looking at? You know, we create that situation. We create that around us. We create that environment around us.
On which note... On which note, I would like to thank you enormously for what has been an incredibly informative, thought-provoking thing. Can you join me in thanking Daniela?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.